Welcome back to Death by Champagne, the podcast here to keep you up at night. We are back to bring you the final installment of our multi-part series covering the book by Jax Miller, Hell in the Heartland. If you aren't caught up, go back and check out episodes 96 and 97 for parts 1 and 2. We come to our tragic conclusion to a 20-year-old cold case. We cover a handful of suspects Jax learns about through her investigations, the more recent arrests and charges placed against the men responsible, and what may have transpired the night the Freeman's trailer went up in flames. This episode contains foul language, discussions about police corruption, small-town life, rape, torture, murder, and drug use. We'll do our best to stay on track, but the bottles are popped. Hi, guys.
Hi, welcome back to Death by Champagne.
So this is our final installment of Hell in the Heartland, covering that book by Jax Miller.
It is almost the episode that didn't go, because when we set up to record, I pulled my computer, like the monitor, away from the wall. I push it back during the day to prop up my work laptop. And when I pulled it forward, the cord for the light that's behind the computer that I use was stuck to it, and it all crashed down on me.
Oh, no.
And so I was, like, pulling cords up and picking it all out. And at first the monitor wasn't turning on. And I was like,
oh, jeez,
I did a bad thing. I just yelled. I was like, come fix it. Come fix it. I broke it.
Oh, my gosh.
But it's working.
That would have been so we're good. Devastation.
It would have.
Good. I don't think we have a whole lot of updates, because this episode is kind of, not kind of, it is very upsetting. So
yeah, I don't know. I mean, we talk for a little bit before each episode starts anyway, so I feel like sometimes by the time we actually turn on the microphone to record, we're kind of like, we talked, we're good.
Yeah,
sometimes yeah. It bleeds over and sometimes it really doesn't. So yeah. I think today we don't have any official, like, business to get on with, so
nope.
I think it might be best today if we just go straight into it.
I'm good with that.
When we left you in episode 2, we had walked through the days after the fire and saw Lorene Bible and her husband Jay put pressure on the negligent investigation started by the Craig County Sheriff's Office. Several theories were put forth by investigators and the Freeman and Bible families, based both on evidence and suspicious lack of. We covered two groups of suspicious people, members of the CCSO, and James Payne, Donovan Maxwell, and Chester Shadwick. Today, we have several more suspects to work through. It can be distracting and frustrating at times to read through the pages of details given on the suspects, leaving the nuclear story behind as we're cloaked in another scene entirely. But these long departures are where we see the people and places wreathed together, and we gain some understanding of the network of secrecy that builds small-town Oklahoma. It's not unlike the sensation of being drunk and drowsy in a car, and suddenly you arrive at a house you never intended to be at. The ends of each chapter in part 3 of Hell in the Heartland are like slamming doors that let in cutting winter air, a curt alarm to your subconscious, bringing you back to what we know. The girls are still missing. We begin immediately where we left off, at the scene of the Shadwick searches, but from a different perspective. Lorene Bible tells Jax that her family had no idea those searches happened until, quote, months later at the Glover searches. Again, her theory is that she was too involved for the OSBI's liking, so they kept as much information as they could away from Lorene, hence the office not filing the paperwork for those Shadwick searches for 3 years.
So with that, we move on to the Glovers. Father and son, Paul Sr. and Jr., were well-known meth manufacturers in Wyandotte, and came to the family's attention via another area lawbreaker, Johnny Rose. In spring of 2001, Rose was working at fruit farms in Oklahoma and told a driver he was working with that he had information about the missing girls from Welch. Jack wonders if this is true or if it was an easy way to make some room in the business. Rose himself was a meth dealer, and the Glovers were kingpins. After they heard about this interaction, they sent a PI to look into the Glovers and the possibility that they knew of or even hosted the long-whispered-of New Year's Eve party, where the girls were rumored to have been treated sickeningly as favors for unsavory guests. The Glovers lived just 3 miles from the Shadwick property. They had a wide reputation concerning their involvement in drug trade. Jay Bible said, in quotes, "If they start shooting at you, you know you're in the right direction." Another source tells Jax, "Shadwick's is where you partied, but the Glovers was business. You don't fuck with business." Nutter pops back in here and says he was able to get a search warrant for the Glover house because of information that started as a jailhouse rumor, different than the story Laureen gives about Johnny Rose bringing it up. As you come to learn reading this book, anything could be nothing or everything. To settle this difference, Jax tries to track the affidavit for that search, and surprise, it's missing. Not surprised.
No, literally never.
Everything's fucking missing from this. There is no record of it being filed with the district court, which she lays out simply, in quotes, "Should anything have been found on the property during this search, and there was, it would have likely been inadmissible in a court of law or grounds for a mistrial." Agent Tammy Ferrari submitted that affidavit finally in 2018. In it, Johnny Rose described seeing Laura and Ashley at the Glover house in, quotes, "shooting pool and not acting right." Rose also claimed a few days after seeing the girls that he saw another person named Nick Joseph driving a backhoe and explained that he was doing some dirt work, possibly grave digging. It's confirmed by Nutter that Joseph had rented this backhoe on February 12th of 2000. The affidavit details that Rose knew Joseph allegedly had dreams about things he had done on the Glover property and told Rose, in quotes, "he was as deeply involved in what was going on as the rest of them," although he was never clear what he meant about that comment. Laureen went to visit Johnny Rose at some point when he was in jail for unrelated crimes, and her anecdote about the interaction is written about just as calmly as any other shocking thing in the book, but made me open my eyes so wide they went out of focus. He wrote the name of his alibi on a piece of paper and swallowed it. It was someone who was again at this New Year's Eve party that everyone in Wyandotte, Welch, and Pitcher seemed to know about, but won't detail to anyone.
That part in the book just, like, confused me as well as shocked me.
Like, oh, yeah.
Why?
Did he show her the piece of paper and then eat it?
I don't think so.
Is that what that was in reference to? He just wrote it down and then ate it?
Yeah. I didn't mark that page to look for sure, but I don't think he showed her. I think he just said, "this is what's on this," and then ate it. I think that was supposed to be, like, is that a reference to how tight-lipped he is about it? He's not going to say anything ever. Like, I won't rat out my sources because there's no,
yeah,
we don't care about your alibi.
Right.
You don't need to, like, that's what you need to prove. It's
right.
It's not like you're giving up a suspect.
Right. But is he saying he wasn't at the New Year's Eve party, or that this alibi would have also then been at the New Year's Eve party?
Yeah, I'm not sure of that whole section. I think that would be a great thing to get some further information on or reread that section. I would like to understand that little bit more.
Yeah. So on July 26, 2001, Detective Eason and a group of OSBI agents searched the Glover property. Jax sets a painfully stark scene, family members standing in hot sunlight, stomachs sick with hope that would end in devastation either way. To their surprise, Nutter approached them after a couple hours and said, "we've got something here." Something is a 12 by 12 piece of bloodstained carpet that was cut from the floor inside the house. Skipping a few pages ahead in the book, I'll ruin it for you. The carpet was handed over for testing, and quote, "there was only radio silence. Every response from the OSBI was that there was a backlog, and when the results were finally obtained 4 years later, the results were arguable. No official results were ever shown to the family." Nutter told each Laureen and Dwayne that it was two different substances, either chainsaw oil or animal blood, which I'm not a fucking scientist or whoever is this job, but those things sound very different.
Yeah.
How is that an option?
I think he had to have been coming at that from a place of so-and-so told me it looks like this, and I'm just repeating what someone told me. Because I certainly don't think he was, like, in the lab with them.
here are the tests, and it's one of those two things.
Yeah, I mean, that had to have just been speculation on someone else's part that he then repeated, because there's
That's true.
Once you're testing that substance for minute detail to see literally what that substance is made of,
you would confirm whether it was one or the other.
I can't imagine. I mean, if you break anything down small enough, there are tons of similarities. But on the surface of what the components are of animal blood and chainsaw oil, they can't look that similar.
Right.
At a certain level in a microscope, you have to know the difference.
Yeah.
So I don't.
Agreed.
And he tells both of those people different things. And then later in the book, when Jax asks him, you told one person this and one person this, do you have anything to say about that? And he kind of is like, I don't remember one of those things. Like, I can't remember which story it is, the chainsaw oil or the blood, but he's like, mm-hmm. I don't remember saying that.
Okay. Just like the Shadwick house, after much promise, nothing at all came from the Glover search. And on page 178, there's a quote, the 3.5 years after the Glover searches didn't feel very long for investigators, but they dragged like a dull knife across the skin of the families of the missing girls, families left in the dark.
I put that in there, and I keep giving myself chills by the things that
literally
I inserted.
So many chills. Yeah.
So we leave the Glovers behind, and we see one of the strangest parts of the story unfold with the source, John Paul Chapman. He's a criminal convicted of 3 counts of sexual battery that he was given probation for because he was so kind as to plead guilty.
Ugh.
I have no words for that.
No.
Other than I can't be that surprised because it was the 90s, so. An ex-girlfriend attributes his violence to meth use, so it's no surprise he ends up around some of the other people we've talked about. Those convictions were from 1996, and he was stuck with another rape charge the day he made bail, when he was dealing with the first 3 crimes. So he's 27 years old, decides to skip town and escape Oklahoma. He runs to Alabama, and Jack spends time interviewing Captain Paul Birch of the Mobile County Sheriff's Office, and much of this information comes from him. Chapman spent the rest of the 90s bouncing between various small towns in Georgia, outrunning the law and making friends that could support him with places to sleep. He burned most of those bridges when the burden of helping him became too much, and he would move on to the next, steadily becoming more and more addicted to meth. From various sources, including Chapman himself, he is described as evil, violent, and paranoid. He readily admits that, quote, once I put the needle in my arm, I was a monster. He also says of himself, not everyone gets the same version of me. One person might say I'm a beautiful soul. Another might tell you I'm a cold-hearted asshole. Believe them both. I don't treat people badly, I treat them accordingly. This is a man who currently sits in prison for murder.
Yeah. Yeah.
Between 2003 and 2004, Jax lists at least 3 times that Chapman is arrested and fingerprinted for charges like indecent exposure and criminal trespassing, but no connection is ever made to him skipping bail in Oklahoma until late 2004. Hurricane Ivan hit Mobile, and Chapman returned right before then in hopes of finding some sort of labor job. He persuaded 2 old friends called the Bentleys to let him stay with them, but when Ivan hit hard, they opted to leave town. He stayed with a cousin of theirs, and the 2 of them prepared to wait it out. While the Bentleys were gone and the storm raged, Chapman stole their .25 caliber handgun. On September 18, 2004, the 2 daughters of Lisa Marie Nichols went to her house after the 44-year-old grocery employee had not come into work that day. They made the horrific discovery that her home had been burned and their mother was inside, dead. It was determined that she was shot 3 times in the head in the bathroom before her body had gasoline poured over it to conceal the crime. There are many articles debating the circumstances of the confession and the influence meth had on the crime, but the answer was obvious to Captain Paul Birch. Quote, there is zero doubt in my mind that John Paul Chapman murdered Lisa Nichols. He enjoyed raping and killing. For this crime, Chapman's fingerprints were entered into the system again, and there was still no hit for his priors. The FBI...
Insane. Insane.
I mean, there's a reason why. But even everything that's connected to him under... I can't say it. I can't get ahead of myself. Give me 2 seconds and we'll come back to this
concept.
Sorry.
Yes.
Okay. The FBI only realized what a huge blunder they'd uncovered after Chapman asked to call his mother. Jean Beard lived in Miami, Oklahoma, and her number was traced. Miami PD was quick to send over the records of Jean Beard's son, and his name was not John. His name was Jeremy Jones, a well-known meth user that frequented hotspots for buying and cooking all throughout northeastern Oklahoma. As police led him to a cell after his confession to killing Lisa Nichols, he stopped and said, "There's something you need to know about some girls in Oklahoma." So here's where I write back in. Reminder, he said, "I don't treat people badly. I treat them accordingly." Let that 6 seconds of silence stay in this audio file. Neither of us has a reaction for how disgusting, untrue, and horrific that is to say.
Oh, yeah, when you've done these things.
I don't know what was on his mind when he made that statement, but...
that he was a badass.
Right. You know? Like, you know, but, I don't know if you're thinking about other instances than when you shot a woman in the head 3 times, but...
Right.
What a complete lack of self-awareness. I have very little patience for that.
Complete lack of self-awareness. Complete.
And past, I think you'll see as we continue this, a lack of self-awareness and a complete refusal to... come to any conclusion that creates any self-awareness or responsibility for actions taken.
Yes.
So as we know him now, Jeremy Jones actually enters this story at a motel in Doraville, Oklahoma, 1 square mile of corroded skeletons of cars that suctions itself at the edge of Route 66. Jax describes a town with little more than 1 bloodstained gas station and a butcher shop. Outside of those 2 spots, the only other place to hang out is the Frontier Motel. But most locals stay away for good reason. And then I wrote, insert a note, buy this book for this chapter alone. I won't ruin the entire description, but this is, again, a section where your brain cannot help but lapse into fiction. The office guy was called BB, and if you weren't settled up with him on your bill, you had to sleep in one of the abandoned cars in the lot behind the motel. So just like that sets the scene. Every person that we describe after that that comes into play, it's like you see them as a person. As they come onto the screen, it's unreal the amount of detail for me that this, like, I could build this set. I could draw you a picture of it. I could cast it out. Like, I don't have any idea what it looks like. I did Google it, but just for me in my head, I was like, okay, well, this is this person. And they come in on the left side of the building. The lot is to the left on the back side. The highway stretches out over the right. I'm just like, I got very lost in this part. It's fantastic writing. But luckily for us, some of these folks have photos included in the book, like Cowboy. His real name is Randy Madewell, and he was at the Frontier Motel the night Jeremy Jones was seen there. Rooms at the motel were only available to rent by the month or by the hour, and Cowboy was there to cook. Jones was pacing back and forth the front... Jones was pacing back and forth past the front office in the very early morning hours of December 30th, 1999. Cowboy colorfully tells Jax about his agenda that night, make meth and beat Jeremy Jones' ass for bothering him. Cowboy's meth was legend to the area, and Jones had knocked on the door 3 times that night, bothering him. Cowboy told Jax, quote, "Jeremy was a rat, I couldn't stand that prick." Shirtless and wearing only underwear with his cowboy boots, Cowboy chased Jeremy away from his room in a fit of meth-induced rage. Jeremy Jones ends up getting arrested, his lack of sleep and intoxication from drink and drugs escalating his nerves to a fever pitch when he was approached by Ottawa County Officer Joe Corley. He was out of control and arrested for public drunkenness and possession of paraphernalia. He was found to have a syringe in his sock. Jones is initially listed as being booked in the Ottawa County Jail at 6 a.m. on December 30th, 1999, but on the report, that 06 was marked out and replaced with 0359. Despite this time discrepancy and Agent Nutter himself being at the Ottawa County office when the call came in that the Freeman trailer was on fire, not much is made of this error in correction. And there were other errors made on that report that were all scratched out and initialed, saying, like, I approve this change. And that one did not have an initial sign off. So back to Chapman / Jones. In his confession, he said he took the girls. Remember, he just said, I have something to say about the girls from Oklahoma.
Yeah.
He said he took the girls to a mining district town called Galena, panicking because they had seen his face, and shot each of them and pushed their bodies into the endlessly deep pits dotting the surface of the land. He later recanted all of his confessions and admitted that he just used that story as leverage to get better treatment in prison. He tells Jax, I wasn't thinking about how this can affect someone's mother. I hope Mrs. Bible can forgive me. Jax notes that Loreen says Jones has never reached out to her, so his apology is worth a hole in a bucket for water. Today, Jeremy Jones is on death row in Alabama for the murder of Lisa Nichols. From AL.com, quote, Jones was also implicated in the deaths of Amanda Greenwell, 16, of Douglasville, Georgia, and Catherine Collins, 45, a New Orleans sex worker. Jones claimed to have killed 21 women in five states in 12 years, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution reported in 2005. And you have most recently heard his name concerning the case of Patrice Endress, the stylist who went missing from her hair salon in Georgia in 2004. Jones is mentioned in the new Unsolved Mysteries episode featuring Patrice's son, Pistol Black. Captain Paul Birch is also in that episode, and he took Jones's confession that he abducted and killed Patrice Endress and threw her off a bridge some 65 miles from her salon. He later recanted this confession and is still a suspect. There is also a book about Jeremy Jones written by Sheila Johnson called Bloodlust. I can't state anything about how that book is. If it's credible, if it's good, I don't know anything. I just saw that it exists, so if you're interested in investigating that further, that might be a place to start. So Captain Birch let Jax listen to Jones's confession tapes for the Nichols murder, and she spent years trying to speak to him directly, only to be ignored, until she made contact with his wife. They met as pen pals when he was in prison. And I'm not going to give away all the detail here, but Jax does eventually make contact with Jeremy himself. He tells long stories about his involvement with drugs, the Freeman family, and the fire, and the murders. His confessions are marred by the inconsistency of mismatched details and possible memory loss from long-term meth use. Jax lays it all out nicely, and there are some gigantic holes in the possibility of Jones' involvement with the Freeman fire. He cannot remember a damn thing. There are differences in the same statement. He'll say, yeah, I remember that long driveway. And then he'll say, well, I walked up because my car was close to the door. Like, just things that don't match up at all. Citing different kinds of guns that he used in the crime, who he shot first. He eventually lands on the idea that he had found the girls after he shot Danny and Kathy and convinced him that he had been driving by, saw the fire, and stopped to help. Which, if was true, is one of the most sinister, disingenuous, fucked up things I've ever heard. The story of Jones' confession goes on and continues to be sloppy and possibly coerced or directed by police. Eventually, Jax realizes that this could be a different murder case with concerningly similar details. Danny Oakley and Doris Harris were killed in their trailer set ablaze in February of 1996. And then I ended this section with, by the book.
Just by the book.
And I've said it 100 times, but it bears repeating, and I'm a Virgo, so I can't help but tell you, this chapter of the book where we start to get into other cases that might be connected to people who might know something, it's a perfect explanation of the Midwest.
It's because everyone knows someone who knows someone who's connected to someone.
Yes, like, which...
every single fucking person.
Just to me, anytime I hear anyone in any ID special on an Oxygen episode of any show on their network, things like that don't happen here. They do. They always do. Things like this happen in every small town. Or it's just the theory that when it becomes a cover-up, when it becomes an unsolvable case, it's the same secrecy that we apply to high school cheerleading tryouts. It's the same secrecy that we apply to our aunts and uncles having affairs. It's the same secrecy that's applied to finding your brother out in the garage doing drugs, except for all of a sudden the stakes are much higher and you have an even bigger reason to not ever say anything.
Yeah.
There's just a little bit of a disconnect, I think, between this could never happen here and this, we set the stage. We made this happen here. There's just so many factors that go into it, and it's wild to read through this section and see how many pieces there are. I'll go ahead and get through this. It's very short. So then we leave Jeremy Jones / Chapman behind, and we're going to talk about Charles Kreider. I'm not going to spend very much time on this at all. It's a much better thing to read in the book, especially if you love scene setting and time spent examining a situation with self-awareness and an open mind. This was one of my favorite bits of Jax as an author and an investigator, reconciling what she thought about someone and everything that she learned through external sources being applied to the real thing. and having to settle those differences personally. So Charles Kreider, Danny's best friend, was convicted of murdering Chautauqua school cook Judith Shrum in 2004 and served time for that crime. He promises Jack's information when he's out, and they do eventually meet. It's worth noting here that Charles also does subscribe to the idea that leading up to the murder for possibly a couple years, Danny was using methamphetamine. In 2016, a tip was sent to Lorene on Facebook telling her to, quote, check the well at the Charles Kreider place. This search happens in January of that year, and nothing tangible comes from it, but it does loosen the glue of locked lips. Many people start to talk about other meth dealers in the area, like Phil Welch, Ronnie Busick, and David Pennington.
Yes, which leads us to our next group of suspects and probably our most devious. Oh, I just read your thing.
Oh, yeah. Olivia had, we divide everything up into sections, and this is her section, so I added a note. Add to this the favorite hymn. It's noted in the book that he liked nothing but the blood. Are you familiar with that song?
Yes.
Yeah, just put that to the background of this, and it's everything you just don't sing need it that to be.
While I read this next part. Yeah.
Heinous.
Throughout Jax's investigation, a number of people are fearful of talking about Phil Welch. Even though he died in 2007 from complications with ALS, that's how deep his legacy runs through the area of Pitcher, described by Jax as, in quotes, a place that sounds like the nightmares of an apocalyptic wasteland. This is a bit of a long quote, but it sums up the image you should be depicting in your mind about Phil Welch. In quotes, he was a well-known meth addict and manufacturer who moved frequently, though never far. When Jax asks around, the most common word associated with him is terrifying. And when she reaches out to one of his stepchildren for the first time, the initial response is a short one. Phil Welch is a horrible man. At this point in our story, we need to backtrack a little to our previous episode when Pryor, one of the private investigators who joins the case, found an insurance card on the edge of the Freeman property. If you recall, he tried to pass this on to Nutter, who was at the time in charge of the OSBI. He was essentially laughed at and threatened with his license being revoked if he didn't get out of the way. So Pryor and Dugan decided to research this insurance card on their own in the early weeks of 2000. Their search led them straight to Warren Phil Welch II. The insurance card in question belonged to a girlfriend of Phil's, and he was driving her car at the time of the fire. It's known that Phil lived in Pitcher from at least October of 1999 until April of 2000. So Pitcher is currently, as Jax describes, a wasteland. What used to be a thriving mining town during the 20s throughout the 50s lays in ruin today. There are roughly 14,000 mines and 36 million tons of toxic waste, all abandoned, when the residents and the American government began to realize what that waste was doing to those who grew up there. Everything was covered in lead and zinc, from the playgrounds to people's driveways. Kids grew up playing in empty mines in areas called watering holes that were filled with toxic chemical waste. A study in 1996 that Jax writes about showed that 46% of children between the ages of 1 to 5 had high concentrations of lead in their blood. And she also notes that that is 11 times the average for the rest of the country. So every home seemed to be filled with some kind of disease, and anything from an increased number of children with learning disabilities to the number of miscarriages a woman would have began to be the normal in Pitcher, but far from normal everywhere else. By our timeline, Pitcher had roughly 1,600 people remaining. Of these 1,600, some were stubborn old folks who were born and raised there and weren't about to leave now just because the government told them to. But far more of that number were people like Phil Welch, taking advantage of the climate, the empty properties, ruined structures, and the poverty level to cook meth, which is exactly why Phil was there.
I do have to interject and say that when I was searching for cover art to use, I was looking at like Shutterstock and websites like that, and when I looked for things specifically of Pitcher, there's a series of images that comes up on one stock site of like really trendy looking kids taking pictures of themselves playing on the piles in
Pitcher.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yeah, it's them, like, it's really bleached out and the lighting is gorgeous. It's, like, super bright and the sky is really pale blue. And they're wearing super trendy, bright, like, pink and yellow clothes.
No.
I mean, they just look like cool skateboard high school boys. And they're, like, jumping and throwing, like, the rocks piles and pitcher.
Oh, my gosh.
I was...
terrifying. Yeah. I mean, the way that Jax writes about this area is, like, very... anxiety inducing thinking about being there, because it is like, especially if you're someone who kind of gets freaked out by illnesses or like can overthink about that, because it's like a Chernobyl site. Not that bad, but like it's bad.
Yeah, I mean there's so few people living there because it's not healthy. You're going to have things.
You should not live there. Yeah.
You're going to have health issues if you live there. I mean, I think at one point they talk about swimming, how people would go swimming and they would just always think that you got a little too sunburned today. But instead of a sunburn, like, that was a chemical burn from how much shit was in the water.
Chemicals. Like,
It reminds me a lot about St. Louis. We could do a whole series
on... there's a whole thing. I literally started researching it for a Patreon episode, and it was too much. I was like, I can't. This could be 10 episodes alone.
Oh, yeah. There's a documentary.
Like, how can I fit this into an hour?
Yeah, and I think there's more than one site in St. Louis where there is...
oh, yeah.
...different kinds of toxic waste.
Yeah. So in mid-January of 2000, Pryor and Duggan came upon Phil walking this wasteland alone, carrying only a Bible. He was known to preach fire and brimstone services to his small following. If he wasn't likely high on meth all the time, or possibly in a less secluded area, I think he could have easily been a cult leader.
We spent so much time talking about the similarities. I wonder, like, I don't know, I would like to... talk more with a lot of different people involved in this story about his personality, because the way he's described oftentimes, he seems out of it and not there. Yeah. Like, he's described as like crazy or crazed.
Yeah. And
I wonder if, I don't know, like, was that part of it? Was he more aware of his actions than... I mean, I think he had to be calculating and manipulative, so I don't know if that would extend to having this act where he portrayed himself as religious, or like how aware was he?
I think it was definitely a method that went with manipulation, because I mean, especially in the Midwest, religion is such a huge thing, and if you can get someone on their faith, even, you know, the lowliest of people in the story, these drug dealers, these meth addicts, like, and then get them to follow you on a faith base, even if you don't believe it. Like,
I think
it's just a manipulation tactic,
especially concerning his children or his stepchildren and how they speak of him, that it seemed like, you know, justifying your horrific treatment of children and other people, because that's what you do for religion, saying you broke this rule of God, so I'm gonna beat you, but also at the same time being strung out on meth and so drunk you can't walk a straight line, which in itself is quite a Midwestern trait to rule with the Bible in one hand and a 40 in the other.
Yeah definitely.
I would really like to speak to a professional about his behavior and see if there is enough information to say, like, he could have been that. Or, like, you know, it was that a little bit.
Right, for, like, a small amount of people, but,
I don't know. Yeah. I think one of the hallmarks is that there has to be an end game of, like, money or end times. You have to be leading up to the end of civilization, or the goal is just money. So,
That's,
I don't know.
True.
Power, I think, could have also been a big enough aspect
for
power.
Him. Mm-hmm. So those who were, I have in quotes, friends, air quotes, with him, seem to be trapped in his religious ramblings. Pryor offers Phil a ride at this point, and he accepts. Pryor notes to Jax that, in quotes, the first impression you get was Charles Manson. They went to a local burger place, and the whole time, Phil's kind of acting strange, transitioning from normal conversation to preaching to silence. At the burger place, Pryor asks Phil point blank, like, did you hear about those girls from Welch? And his response is, yeah, I heard about them two little bitches. They then proceed to casually ask Phil, knowing full well who he is, that, you know, they've heard that a guy named Phil Welch was responsible. and does he know of Phil Welch? And he tells them, yeah, I'm Phil Welch. And then it's at this point that kind of his coherency is gone. Like, after that, he's just not really making sense, the things he's saying to them, and he quickly wants to get away. And from that moment, Pryor felt strongly that Phil had something to do with the fire and Ashley and Laura's disappearances. One of Jax's sources asked her, "Have you ever seen the devil? Because I have, and it was Phil Welch."
I think there are a lot of, I mean, you know my theory of, like, people who commit crimes are not monsters. They are the same as us. They just have different things happening in their circumstances and in their brain. So I tend to notice really brightly when someone is like, Jeremy Jones, like, you looked right through him. His eyes were black. His soul was black. He's described by several people as being pure evil, including himself. Yeah. And so when other people describe Phil Welch as the devil or like Satan incarnate, I think those are devices that we rely upon to explain things we don't understand.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So I think it's, I don't know, it's interesting to me that so many people have those things to say about these men where, you know, and you know, this is a big example compared to watching one episode of a TV show, listening to one podcast about a case. It's a whole book dedicated to not just the victims, the person that did this crime and the investigation. It has to be a survey of the entire area and all of these people that touch it. So I think it is interesting to see in this case that so many people
say definitely
he has the preceding reputation of a serial killer, of a cult leader, of someone who everyone is afraid of.
Versus even just, you know, someone who knows of him in this small town and then is like, oh, yeah, not surprised. Like that, you know, versus that response of being like, yeah, I'm not surprised that he was involved or killed some people. But everyone is adamantly like, oh, he's evil. Like, I don't even say his name. kind of situation.
Yeah, it goes above. It goes above thinking, yeah, I think he could be guilty. It's like, let's not talk about it because I don't want. Even though he's dead.
Yes, that's literally my next sentence is I keep referencing these quotes about Phil, you know, being devil and evil and horrible, but truly whatever power this man held over people was almost supernatural. Like, that is the explanation for it. It doesn't make sense in this world. Law enforcement was even afraid of him. So usually nothing was done regarding the family members, girlfriends, and children that he beat and sexually abused. Nothing was done regarding his production and distribution of meth, and nothing was done when rumors began to circulate that Phil Welch and his accomplices at this time, David Pennington and Ronnie Busick, were to blame for the Freeman fire and the fate of Ashley Freeman and Laura Bible. So these three individuals had a long list of felonies ranging from drugs to assault. Ronnie and David both grew up in Chautauqua. Okay. From very similar homes with abusive fathers and absent mothers. They followed Phil around like they were puppies, and he was the only one giving them food, which is kind of the reality. Phil gave them drugs. They did his bidding, and he surrounded it all in some weird gospel belief system that David and Ronnie fell into headfirst. Though a number of people to this day are still hesitant to speak up about what they heard, what they saw, or what they maybe even know as fact surrounding this case and Phil Welch's involvement, there are a few who do talk to Jax in her book. And hopefully with the recent arrests and charges being made, we will get to in just a moment, there will be more people coming forward to share information. So, as we've mentioned a number of times, a lot of this reads like fiction, but we have to remember that there are still two missing girls, two very real girls with families seeking closure. Jax unravels rumors and stories passed on like a game of telephone from one person to the next until possible truths are finally revealed. Some of this is very upsetting, like I said in the last episode, as we cycle through our suspect list and come down to our conclusion, we realize that some of the worst people are involved, which makes this all the more heartbreaking and something that sticks with you. There are many people who remember the missing persons flyer of Ashley and Laura hanging up in Phil's trailer. There are also a number of people who remember seeing Polaroids of two teenage girls tied up and gagged in Phil's possession. and a number of people who remember Phil having whispered conversations or even outright confessions about getting rid of some people in Welch who owed him drug money, consistently using the same phrase about taking care of those two little bitches. This isn't new information to anyone who lived in the area, nor was it new information to the OSBI or CCSO. 1 year after the fires, in early 2001, Nutter interviewed Phil's most recent girlfriend at the time, and she told him not only about the Polaroids, but also about Phil knowing Danny Freeman, and that Danny owed Phil money. I think that was like a big misconnection from law enforcement, that the track of Phil Welch being involved, it was like, why?
Yeah.
Why would, you know, Danny Freeman didn't know him. Phil Welch, they were from different towns. You know, like some people did say that Danny was doing meth, but a lot of people said he didn't. So I think there was that line that it never connected the two of them knowing each other. But it is stated that in 2001, Phil's girlfriend told Nutter of the OSBI that no, they did know each other. And Danny apparently owed Phil money at the time. So shortly after Pryor and Dugan trace the insurance card to Phil Welch, they actually find the car that belonged to his ex, the one that Phil would have been driving that night, and they find it in a salvage yard. Pryor contacted law enforcement and requested for the car to be processed and was told that the car had passed through too many hands to be used as evidence, which is, I mean, bullshit to me. If the girl's DNA was in the car, that's enough to prove that whoever was driving the car, you know, had them in it, right? Well, like, all you need to know is if the girl's DNA is in there or not. Like, that's the main thing.
Who are you? Your job is to find the evidence and then pass it along to the people that test it. Your job is not to be the judge and the jury and say what is of use and not. When right. you're not even the person that has the capabilities to test that yourself.
Right.
What he needed to do, what anyone in charge of that investigation needed to do, was secure that car.
Yes.
And take it into possession.
Yes. And then at least you can knock it off the list if there's nothing there.
It's just baffling. Like, I mean, I think the difference, hopefully, I mean, the difference is an honest, hardworking investigator, first of all.
Yeah.
The other difference, hopefully, is the years between when that car was found and today. That an investigator mm-hmm. today would say, it doesn't matter if there are 25 different sets of fingerprints in that car, or if we find 14 different hairs, one of them could match to a family yes. member.
Yes. That's all.
And it's, again, I have to say, it's easy for me to sit here and quarterback from my chair in my sweatpants with a gin drink in my hand.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Especially
we all
when
know. We
I
know.
Call, it's no, you know, you should do your
hindsight
job this
is
way.
2020, but it's just like blatantly obvious that a lot wasn't done.
it's clear. And I think it's
not, yeah, it's not
all
just
the
like
more transparent
yeah.
and painfully clear that nothing was handled correctly mm-hmm. because of how unbiased this book is.
Yes. Oh, yes. Absolutely.
With this the restraint is and the respect showed to everyone involved, it just makes it more clear how
yes.
bungled it was.
Oh, yeah. This is the one quote I pulled from the book that even gives an ounce of, like, slight unbiased opinion, but it's not even that unbiased because this is directly after Jax explains that Pryor found the car and that apparently this is what he was told. So she's saying, if his story is true, then I wonder if this case met with either the most inept or the most corrupt collection of law enforcement agencies ever seen in American history. So again, this alone is enough to make me put blame. I mean, obviously you can't put blame on anyone other than the people who killed the Freemans and the girls. Like, you did not have to do that. That was your choice to murder them. And no one else can be at fault for that, but people can be at fault for not doing their jobs as they should have been done, because these girls likely could have been found prior to their deaths if what we know now is true, which is that
right.
they were likely alive for 2 weeks after they were taken.
Right.
Two
if some of this
weeks.
Had been actually looked into
and it didn't
promptly.
It didn't take long for the private investigators to find the connection with the insurance card. Did not take long.
Yeah. Their direct quote was, "Why don't you go do a job somewhere else and leave this scene?"
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When just refusing. Like, imagine refusing something that was found on the crime scene you're working.
And it ends up being the key to finding who did this. Yeah.
Take your cowboy boots and start walking down the road and don't stop until, I don't even know,
don't
until the heels
ever.
Are worn off your boots and your legs are cramping.
It's just very sad because it's like, what was the point? Like, what was the point of not taking that insurance card? What did you have at the scene that was more important to look into?
Nothing, because they didn't
Nothing.
Do anything.
Exactly. Exactly. Like, there's no excuse. There's no fucking excuse.
Yeah.
None.
There are multiple points in this book where.
Yeah.
I mean, again, one more time. There's hindsight's 20/20. You can't compare one investigator situation to another, or a person like us who is just interested and has no formal training. But there are several points when I texted my dad and I was like, what's an explanation for this? Why would someone not file this paperwork? Why would you literally not take evidence into your property? Like, why would you not take it into your possession? And he was like, there's not an answer for that.
Yeah.
Like, unless there's something Straight else that up. Was going on that you don't know about. Like, he was like, on the surface level, there's no reason why they shouldn't have taken that insurance card, why the car shouldn't have been investigated, all of
Yes.
it.
Yes. Gosh. So on April 26th of 2018, Ronnie Dean Busick, who was 66, was charged with 4 counts of first-degree murder for the killings of Danny, Kathy, and Ashley Freeman and Laura Bible. This arrest came after a relative of Busick's came forward and told law enforcement that Ronnie confessed to him that he had been involved. 2 more suspects were named on the day of his arrest and charges: David Pennington and Phil Welch, who both had already passed. As I mentioned before, Phil died in 2007 and David died in 2015, making a deathbed confession supposedly naming Charles Kreider as the suspect that law enforcement should be looking into, which we briefly spoke of, but again, that whole story has got to be read. Like, it's just, it's so much. You got to read it yourself.
So we didn't really, it feels a little abrupt at the end of this series to come to a conclusion and have arrests being reported on. There's less information given about these 3 than other suspects, but that's kind of how it goes in the book too, is that, you know, all the connections had to be explored. And Phil Welch, while he was prominent and on people's radars, he really, like Olivia said, there was minimal line drawn between him and Danny.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of covering these 3 men, a lot of it is not necessarily accounts from people that endured their abuse. It's like secondhand accounts from like, oh, well, I know that he did this. You know, so it's not like a lot of the other stuff that we talk about is like confirmed by like a victim or death reports, things like that. And then the stuff surrounding these 3 guys, there just isn't.
Yeah, it's hard to build a whole picture. I mean, we get a lot of information on Phil Welch, but again, it's secondhand information and it's hard to reckon in my mind that like after every time you finish a chapter, you're like, it's that guy.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And then you get to the end and it's like, well, it's this guy that lived there the whole time and was a huge meth dealer and he was
and
a giant piece of
monster.
Shit, but we just didn't get to it and he's dead. So there's no, there's minimal record to put against it. So rather than giving Ronnie Busick a bunch of time in this episode, I just have a couple of quotes. One, Jax interviews his niece, Dawn. So this quote on page 269. "Today, Dawn seems of high intelligence, the kind that comes with a touch of crazy, and she talks fast, with frequent use of the word fuck. He actually never touched me, but when I was no longer a child, I'd call him Uncle Bad Touch." The chapter on Ronnie Busick, while short, is quite damning concerning his awareness of the crimes and bullshit he was getting himself into, and how he knew that that wasn't acceptable and just did not care. So Dawn would sleep at their house, and Ronnie's parents, when he was at the house, knew to keep younger children away from him. They were concerned that that would be an issue. On one notable occasion, Ronnie said of the girls in his life, "If they don't want to give it up, then by God, I fucking take it." But in the mercurial fashion of meth addiction, he'd say in the same breath, If only I'd married a sweet little thing like you, I'd never get in any of these messes. Speaking to his niece.
Disgusting. Filth.
Inexcusable.
Trash.
Trash garbage. On fire. No. One more quote for Ronnie Busick, and then I have no more time to give to that man. For Don, one of the most memorable things about growing up with Ronnie Busick coming in and out of the home was a specific cowboy belt buckle he sported. One with a cartoonish depiction of a woman with her legs spread, viewed from the explicit perspective of a gynecologist. Quote, he'd call me over and measure my head against his waist and say, honey, if only your head was flat, I'd marry you. He was referring to a place for a man to set his beer while receiving oral sex.
Literally disgusting.
Slam the book closed, throw it over my head.
Fuck off, you piece of pure filth. Can't.
No.
Ugh. Well, continuation on to that. On July 15th of this year, 2020, Ronnie pled guilty to accessory of first-degree murder in the deaths of Danny and Kathy Freeman, the fire that engulfed their home, and the abduction of both Ashley Freeman and Laura Bible. His plea deal requires that he assist law enforcement with locating the remains of Ashley and Laura, though he continues to claim that he wasn't involved with the girls' killings. The most recent information led to a search on August 18th of this year of a property in Pitcher, but nothing was found. So according to Ronnie, which as we are all aware, we can only take what a convicted criminal may say with a grain of salt, especially considering he's the only one left alive to speak of the events in question. He claims that the night of the fire, Phil told Ronnie and David that they were going to make a trip down to Welch to visit Danny Freeman and get paid back a debt that he owed them. One key item that Jax links in her book is a story told to her about Phil Welch demonstrating what he would do to incapacitate a man, which is break his collarbone. And if you recall, Danny Freeman had a broken collarbone, suspected to have happened just before he died. It is at this point that Ronnie says he stayed in the car while David and Phil went inside. Upon entering the home and confronting Danny, all while Phil is wearing a trench coat with a hidden shotgun, it doesn't go very smoothly. Danny goes for a gun, Phil breaks his collarbone, and then shoots him. Meanwhile, Kathy hears this play out while she's in the bedroom and attempts to retrieve the gun from under their bed when Phil enters and shoots her. The girls can obviously hear the commotion, and with Ashley's bedroom being right by the back door, they run. In some stories, Ronnie claims they ran into the woods. In others, he claims they ran and laid outside in the prairie. And when Phil and David are done ransacking the place, they light it on fire. Again, our version of events changes slightly, that when the fire started, the girls ran out of the woods, or when the fire started, they were now visible, laying on the ground in the prairie with this huge flame showing where they are. And one thing that does seem consistent with at least Ronnie's story is that Ashley and Laura run, and they run in separate directions, which is when Phil and David each take after one and catch them. They tie them up, gag them with a sock, and force them into the back of the car.
I think that note about, I don't know, it's like so much of this book and this case forever has been... Like, I've known about this forever, and just not knowing what happened in the house that night is consistently the thing that, when you read about this, it's just maddening. It's like, how do we have no answers? Like, there's nothing that says, like, in what order things happened. And so finally, for this to be the end, that you see two sweet 16-year-old girls running out the back door for their lives, and that they might have thought it was okay for them to stand up and that they would get away and realize that they're still standing over them. Like, to completely break from me saying we don't call criminals or murderers monsters, to the complete flip side, this is what horror movies are written about.
Yes.
This is what Texas Chainsaw Massacre is. This
exactly.
This is the type of thing where you do look at it and say, oh, this is fiction. This has to be so bad that it can't be real.
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. Roughly, I guess a little more than halfway through the book, there's a part that I'm just going to read straight from the book. It's like a paragraph and a half because it just is literally the perfect description. So I'm just going to do that. But it is a witness of that night that I think is very important. And unfortunately, like a lot of stuff from this case, wasn't taken seriously or looked into till much, much later. So a woman named Winnie, living near the area. So according to the Old Farmer's Almanac, there was visibility of 9.9 miles, which, if it had been light, would have allowed Winnie to see the chimney smoke of her closest neighbors some 5 miles out. But then the wind dropped, and the sound came of a roaring engine in the distance closing in. It was unusual to spot a car around here, even in the daytime, but at this ungodly hour and with no sign of headlights to accompany the noise, it was just unnerving. Winnie's gut rippled with fear. She stepped back off the edge of the road and took shelter in the darkness, sewn into bushes of juniper. She held her breath as a spotlight washed the 1980s model car in silver and yellow for a moment. Not far from where Winnie stood, camouflaged, the car suddenly stopped. The driver braking hard enough to create a large cloud of dust that further hid Winnie, but kept her from seeing clearly. In that moment, she thought she'd been spotted. While the car still ran, one of the doors opened, so the interior light glowed through the dirt, and the dinging sounded to alert of an open door. A scuffle, a screech of a female, a deep roar from a man's throat. The commotion lasted only a few seconds, but Winnie knew fear when she heard it, and the indecipherable voices relayed to her that something was very wrong. The door slammed shut, and the lightless car left as fast as it could. So this, she immediately, I think the next day, once she hears about what happened at the Freeman property, she calls the police. And she talks to her dad. He agrees. She needs to call the police. She gives their statement, and it's not, no one comes by. She gives her, like, she tells the police over the phone what happens. They tell her that an officer will be out to formally take your statement. And it never happens. And then Laureen Bible finds out about it, and she takes her statement and gives it to the investigators in 2016. So it's like Laureen didn't even know this instance happened. I mean, they clearly didn't really know each other, so it's not something she would have brought up maybe to people. And obviously, if you pass this information on to the police, you think that something's going to be done with it.
Right. And I'm sure, yeah, given everything we've been told about Ronnie Busick, David Pennington, and Phil Welch, that's not something I would repeat more than once when you've already told the police.
Right. Oh, for sure. For sure. Especially when you start hearing rumors that they might be involved. Like, they know the route they took that night. Right. They know what houses they passed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So after this, it's truly anyone's guess as to what horrors befell Ashley and Laura. Busick's story has been ever-changing, from rape and torture to the most recent account of them being shot up with meth. We also may never know for certain if they were at this infamous New Year's Eve party or how many people were truly involved in their deaths in the days that followed the fire. The current district attorney investigator in charge of the case, Gary Stansel, believes Ashley and Laura were kept alive for 2 weeks. And again, I sound like a fucking broken record, but if someone had done their job from the beginning, I truly think that they could have been found.
Yeah, I think even if they...
If more was done.
Yeah, even if the result wasn't that they were found alive, I don't think right. that this
even
would
if
be...
that, they would have at least been found.
Right. This wouldn't be the years-long saga that it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So again, we default to what we know and tune out the white noise of false confessions and inexcusable excuses. The girls are still missing. Where are Laura and Ashley? If Ronnie Busick doesn't know, I would go so far as to say that if there are any two people on this earth who are capable of finding them, it's Laureen Bible and Jax Miller, with the support of the rest of Laura and Ashley's families. So to end, we have a quote from Laureen, who deserves so much credit, and I know just from reading this book and talking to Jax about this case, she wouldn't accept any credit for this. It's not going above and beyond. It's what you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a scene in the book where we're finally at the announcement of the arrest affidavit for Ronnie Busick, and there's a press conference, and this is on page 265. Laureen steps forward again, allowing herself to show some of the emotion she typically saves for private moments. I was told earlier today that sometimes I seem kind of hard, she admits, pointing to Jay beside her and acknowledging how it's usually Jay who is perceived to be demonstrative. As her voice begins to waver under the strain of holding back tears, she manages to stop herself. I fight. That tearful mom will be there when I find my daughter. But until then, how hard? How hard do I have to fight? I need to know, because it's been a fight. No one in the audience speaks a word. There is no rush of reporters asking questions, no clearing of a throat, not even the sound of a deep breath. When Laureen speaks, the world listens, and after a moment of silence, Laureen gestures wordlessly to open the floor. She also says later, I'm a storm to be reckoned with, she continues to reporters. You can come with me, or I'm going on my own. Laura turned 35 on the 18th. She's been gone more than half her life. I need a place where I can say, that's where my daughter is. I used to go to the Freeman's driveway and put out wreaths, but it's just a driveway. When you lose a loved one, you could go to a cemetery. I don't have that, and that's what I want. And that is the end of our series covering Hell in the Heartland by Jax Miller and the case of Laura Bible and Ashley Freeman and Danny and Kathy Freeman.
Yes.
I think it's important to direct you to a couple of sources. Obviously, you can follow Jax Miller on Twitter at RealJaxMiller, J-A-X-M-I-L-L-E-R. And to keep up with case updates and the Bible family, you can follow their page at bbi-findlaurabible, and her name again is spelled L-A-U-R-I-A, on Facebook. They have a very large Facebook group where they post current news, and Laureen is in ill health right now, so you can get some updates there and find out different ways to support their family. I know that there is a scholarship fund set up in the girls' names, so if you feel so inclined to donate to that or look up another way that you can send them just a nice note. They are truly a family that has gone through the worst that life could offer them and consistently just says, we're here to do what we have to do. Save your tears, save your anger, save all your effort for Laura and Ashley. So like we said, this is our last episode for the Hell in the Heartland series. We hope we've made you angry, and we hope that you have an appreciation for this case that kept me awake as many like undergrad nights when I had other things to do. Yeah. And I was like, what's this thing? I need to know all about it. And now,
yeah,
I mean, both gratefully, honorably, and unfortunately, I know so much about it.
Yeah.
And I'm forever grateful that such a small thing that was like, oh, I'm going to look at this and know more information about it, to however many years from when I first learned about this case to getting this book, it's like I got the full answer. And I think that it is so incredible and impressive that Jax dedicated so much of her life to figuring this out and taking the time to say, this is the entire story that those girls and their families deserve.
Right.
So, upcoming after this series, we have our 100th episode.
Woo!
And in true fashion, we have no idea what we're going to do for it, so.
Literally no idea. Mariah said there was like a poll or something.
Oh, yeah, I put a poll on Patreon.
Oh, okay. I was like, wait, where? Because she was like, I think I picked the last option. Or she said something about it, and I was like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, I put the last option. I gave three options for things that people would like us to talk about or do for 100th episode, okay. And the last one was go off the rails, break the genre.
Okay, got it. I think that's what she said she picked. I don't know.
Perfect.
I don't remember.
So if you're a patron, you can go and vote in that poll, see what you would want us to talk about for our 100th episode. We also, I did say that we would accept Q&A questions for that. If we get a ton, we'll make it a bonus episode. I would never give you a Q&A in place of a real episode. I cannot stand when shows do that.
No, that's annoying.
I know. Yeah. Like, I don't like you that much. I don't want to listen to you talk for about yourself for that long.
We already do that for apparently too long at the beginning of our episode.
I know. So, yeah, if you're not a patron, you don't have access to the poll, but you can still tweet us, Instagram us, wherever. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Dead From Shamps, on Facebook at Death by Champagne Podcast. You can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/deathbychampagne. For as little as $2 a month, you can have bonus episodes and get all of your regular episodes ad-free and a day early. And if you're not into Patreon but want to support us, you can go to iTunes or your favorite podcatcher and give us 5 stars. Thanks for listening. Until next time.
We're here to keep you up at night.
Hail Satan.
And pop some bottles.
Gorgeous. I'm not even going to try it. I have one shitty cup and a magnet. Delicate.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Thank you for listening to this one. Bum 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 b